Without pause, Eragon located the minds of each of the now unprotected soldiers and killed them as well. The Varden cheered as the knot of men went limp. The ease with which he slew them amazed Eragon. The soldiers had had no chance to escape or fight back. How different from Fardandur, he thought. Though he marvelled at the perfection of his skills, the deaths sickened him. But there was no time to dwell on it. Recovering from the Varden's initial assault, the Empire began to man their engines of war, catapults that cast round missiles of hard-baked ceramic, trebuchets armed with barrels of liquid fire, and ballistae that bombarded the attackers with a hail of arrows 6 feet long. The ceramic balls and the liquid fire caused terrific damage when they landed. One ball exploded against the ground not 10 yards from Saphira. As Eragon ducked behind his shield, a jagged fragment spun toward his head, only to be stopped dead in the air by one of his wards. He blinked at the sudden loss of energy. The engines soon stalled the Varden's advance, sowing mayhem wherever they aimed. "They have to be destroyed if we're going to last long enough to wear down the Empire," realized Eragon. It would be easy for Saphira to dismantle the machines, but she dared not fly among the soldiers for fear of an attack by magic. Breaking through the Varden lines, 8 soldiers stormed towards Saphira, jabbing at her with pikes. Before Eragon could draw Zarok, the dwarves and Kull eliminated the entire group.
"A good fight!"
roared Garshvog.
"A good fight!"
agreed Oryk, with a bloody grin. Eragon did not use spells against the engines. They would be protected against any conceivable enchantment. Unless... extending himself, he found the mind of a soldier who tended one of the catapults. Though he was sure the soldier was defended by some magician, Eragon was able to gain dominance over him and direct his actions from afar. He guided the man up to the weapon which was being loaded, then had him use his sword to hack at the skein of twisted rope that powered the machine. The rope was too thick to sever before the soldier was dragged away by his comrades, but the damage was already done. With a mighty crack, the partially wound skein broke, sending the arm of the catapult flying backward and injuring several men. His lips curled in a grim smile, Eragon proceeded to the next catapult and in short order disabled the remainder of the engines. Returning to himself, Eragon became aware of dozens of the Varden collapsing around Saphira. One of Duvrangur Gata had been overwhelmed. He uttered a dreadful curse and flung himself back along the trail of magic as he searched for the man who cast the fatal spell, entrusting the welfare of his body to Saphira and his guards. For over an hour, Eragon hunted Galbatorix's magicians, but to little avail, for they were wily and cunning, and did not directly attack him. Their reticence puzzled Eragon until he tore from the mind of one spellcaster, moments before he committed suicide, the thought, "Ordered not to kill you or the dragon. Not to kill you or the dragon." "That answers my question," he said to Saphira. "But why does Galbatorix still want us alive? We've made it clear we support the Varden." Before she could respond, Nasawada appeared before them, her face streaked with filth and gore, her shield covered with dents, blood sheeting down her left leg from a wound on her thigh.
"Eragon," she gasped, "I need you, both of you, to fight, to show yourselves and embolden the men, to frighten the soldiers."
Her condition shocked Eragon.
"Let me heal you first," he cried, afraid she might faint. "I should have put more wards around her." "No, I can wait, but we are lost unless you stem the tide of soldiers."
Her eyes were glazed and empty, blank holes in her face.
"We need a rider."
She swayed in her saddle. Eragon saluted her with Zarok.
"You have one, my lady. Go," she said, "and may what gods there are watch over you."
Eragon was too high on Saphira's back to strike his enemies below, so he dismounted and positioned himself by her right paw. To Oryk and Garshvarg he said, "Protect Saphira's left side, and whatever you do, don't get in our way."
"You will be overrun, Fire Sword."
"No," said Eragon, "I won't. Now take your places."
As they did, he put his hand on Saphira's leg and looked her in one clear-cut sapphire eye. "Shall we dance, friend of my heart?"
"We shall, little one."
Then he and she merged their identities to a greater degree than ever before, vanquishing all differences between them to become a single entity. They bellowed, leaped forward, and forged a path to the front line. Once there, Aragorn could not tell from whose mouth emanated the ravenous jet of flame that consumed a dozen soldiers, cooking them in their mail, nor whose arm it was that brought Zarok down in an arc, cleaving a soldier's helm in half. The metallic scent of blood clogged the air, and curtains of smoke wafted over the burning plains, alternately concealing and revealing the knots, clumps, ranks, and battalions of thrashing bodies. Overhead, the carrion birds waited for their meal, and the sun climbed in the firmament toward noon. From the minds of those around them, Aragorn and Saphira caught glimpses of how they appeared. Saphira was always noticed first, a great ravening creature with claws and fangs dyed red, who slew all in her path with swipes of her paws and lashes of her tail, and with billowing waves of flame that engulfed entire platoons of soldiers. Her brilliant scales glittered like stars and nearly blinded her foes with their reflected light. Next, they saw Aragorn running alongside Saphira. He moved faster than the soldiers could react, and with strength beyond men, splintered shields with a single blow, rent armour, and clove the swords of those who opposed him. Shot and dart cast at him, fell to the pestilent ground 10 feet away, stopped by his wards. It was harder for Aragorn, and by extension Saphira, to fight his own race than it had been to fight the Urgals in Fardendur. Every time he saw a frightened face or looked into a soldier's mind, he thought, "This could be me." But he and Saphira could afford no mercy. If a soldier stood before them, he died. 3 times they sallied forth, and 3 times Aragorn and Saphira slew every man in the Empire's first few ranks, before retreating to the main body of the Varden to avoid being surrounded. By the end of their last attack, Aragorn had to reduce or eliminate certain wards around Arya, Oric, Nasuada, Saphira, and himself in order to keep the spells from exhausting him too quickly. For though his strength was great, so too were the demands of battle. "Ready?" he asked Saphira after a brief respite. She growled an affirmative. A cloud of arrows whistled toward Aragorn the instant he dove back into combat. Fast as an elf, he dodged the bulk of them, since his magic no longer protected him from such missiles, caught 12 on his shield, and stumbled as one struck his belly and one his side. Neither shaft pierced his armour, but they knocked the wind out of him and left bruises the size of apples. "Don't stop! You've dealt with worse pain than this before," he told himself. Rushing a cluster of 8 soldiers, Aragorn darted from one to the next, knocking aside their pikes and jabbing Zarok like a deadly bolt of lightning. The fighting had dulled his reflexes, though, and one soldier managed to drive his pike through Aragorn's hauberk, slicing his left tricep. The soldiers cringed as Saphira roared. Aragorn took advantage of the distraction to fortify himself with energy stored within the ruby in Zarok's pommel, and then to kill the 3 remaining soldiers. Sweeping her tail over him, Saphira knocked 10 men out of his way. In the lull that followed, Aragorn looked over at his throbbing arm and said, "Waysay heal." He also healed his bruises, relying upon Zarok's ruby, as well as the diamonds in the belt of Beloth the Wise. Then the 2 of them pressed onward. Aragorn and Saphira choked the burning plains with mountains of their enemies, and yet the Empire never faltered or fell back. For every man they killed, another stepped forth to take his place. A sense of hopelessness engulfed Aragorn, as the mass of soldiers gradually forced the Varden to retreat toward their own camp. He saw his despair mirrored in the faces of Nasuada, Arya, King Orin, and even Angela when he passed them in battle. "All our training and we still can't stop the Empire," raged Aragorn. "There are just too many soldiers. We can't keep this up forever, and Zarok and the Belt are almost depleted."
"You can draw energy from your surroundings if you have to."
"I won't, not unless I kill another of Galbatorix's magicians and can take it from the soldiers. Otherwise I'll just be hurting the rest of the Varden, since there are no plants or animals here I can use to support us." As the long hours dragged by, Aragorn grew sore and weary, and stripped of many of his arcane defences, accumulated dozens of minor injuries. His left arm went numb from the countless blows that hammered his mangled shield. A scratch on his forehead kept blinding him with rivulets of hot, sweat-mixed blood. He thought one of his fingers might be broken. Saphira fared no better. The soldier's armour tore the inside of her mouth, dozens of swords and arrows cut her unprotected wings, and a javelin punctured one of her own plates of armour, wounding her in the shoulder. Aragorn saw the spear coming and tried to deflect it with a spell, but was too slow. Whenever Saphira moved, she splattered the ground with hundreds of drops of blood. Beside them, three of Oryk's warriors fell and two of the Khal. And the sun began its descent toward evening. As Eragon and Saphira prepared for their seventh and final assault, a trumpet sounded in the east, loud and clear, and King Orin shouted, "The dwarves are here! The dwarves are here!"
"Dwarves?"
Eragon blinked and glanced around, confused. He saw nothing but soldiers. Then a jolt of excitement raced through him as he understood. "The dwarves!" He climbed onto Saphira and she jumped into the air, hanging for a moment on her tattered wings as they surveyed the battlefield. It was true! A great host marched out of the east toward the burning plains. At its head strode King Hrothgar, clad in gold mail, his jeweled helm upon his brow, and Volund, his ancient warhammer, gripped in his iron fist. The dwarf king raised Volund in greeting when he saw Eragon and Saphira. Eragon howled at the top of his lungs and returned the gesture, brandishing Zarok in the air. A surge of renewed vigour made him forget his wounds and feel fierce and determined again. Saphira added her voice to his, and the Vardan looked to her with hope, while the Empire's soldiers hesitated with fear.
"What did you see?"
cried Oryk as Saphira dropped back to earth.
"Is it Hrothgar? How many warriors did he bring?"
Ecstatic with relief, Eragon stood in his stirrups and shouted, "Take heart! King Hrothgar is here, and it looks like every single dwarf is behind him. We'll crush the Empire!" After the men stopped cheering, he added, "Now take your swords and remind these flea-bitten cowards why they should fear us. Charge!" Just as Saphira leaped toward the soldiers, Eragon heard a second cry, this one from the west. "A ship! A ship is coming up the Jeet River!"
"Blast it!" he snarled. "We can't let a ship land if it's bringing reinforcements for the Empire."
Contacting Triana, he said, "Tell Nasawada that Saphira and I will take care of this. We'll sink the ship if it's from Galbatorix."
"As you wish, Arjad Lam," replied the sorceress.
Without hesitation, Saphira took flight, circling high over the trampled, smoking plain. As a relentless clamour of combat faded from his ears, Eragon took a deep breath, feeling his mind clear. Below, he was surprised by how scattered both armies had become. The Empire and the Vardan had disintegrated into a series of smaller groups, contending against one another over the entire breadth and width of the burning plains. It was into this confused tumult that the dwarves inserted themselves, catching the Empire from the side, as Orin had done earlier with his cavalry. Eragon lost sight of the battle when Saphira turned to her left and soared through the clouds in the direction of the Jeet River. A gust of wind blew the peat smoke out of their way and unveiled a large three-masted ship riding upon the orange water, rowing against the current with two banks of oars. The ship was scarred and damaged and flew no colours to declare its allegiance. Nevertheless, Eragon readied himself to destroy the vessel. As Saphira dove toward it, he lifted Zarok overhead and loosed his savage war cry. Convergence. Roran stood at the prow of the Dragonwing and listened to the oars swish through the water. He had just finished a stint rowing, and a cold, jagged ache permeated his right shoulder. "Will I always have to deal with this reminder of the Razak?" He wiped the sweat from his face and ignored the discomfort, concentrating instead on the river ahead, which was obscured by a bank of sooty clouds. Elaine joined him at the railing. She rested a hand on her swollen belly.
"The water looks evil," she said. "Perhaps we should have stayed in Douth rather than drag ourselves in search of more trouble."
He feared she spoke the truth. After the Boar's Eye, they had sailed east from the Southern Isles back to the coast and then up the mouth of the Jeet River to Cerdra's port city of Douth. By the time they made landfall, their stores were exhausted and the villagers sickly. Roran had every intention of staying in Douth, especially after they'd received an enthusiastic welcome from its governor, Lady Alaris. But that was before he was told about Galbatorix's army. If the Vardan were defeated, he would never see Katrina again. So with the help of Jode, he convinced Horst and many of the other villagers that if they wanted to live in Cerdra, safe from the Empire, they had to row up the Jeet River and assist the Vardan. It was a difficult task, but in the end Roran prevailed. And once they told Lady Alaris about their quest, she gave them all the supplies they wanted. Since then, Roran often wondered if he made the right choice. By now, everyone hated living on the Dragonwing. People were tense and short-tempered, a situation only aggravated by the knowledge they were sailing toward a battle. Was it all selfishness on my part? Wondered Roran. Did I really do this for the benefit of the villagers, or only because it will bring me one step closer to finding Katrina? Perhaps we should have, he said to Elaine. Together they watched as a thick layer of smoke gathered overhead, darkening the sky, obscuring the sun, and filtering the remaining light, so that everything below was coloured a nauseating hue of orange. It produced an eerie twilight the likes of which Roran had never imagined. The sailors on deck looked about fearfully and muttered charms of protection, pulling out stone amulets to ward off the evil eye.
Listen, said Elaine. She tilted her head. What is that?
Roran strained his ears and caught the faint ring of metal striking metal. That, he said, is the sound of our destiny. Twisting, he shouted back over his shoulder. Captain, there's fighting just ahead.
Man the ballistae! Roared Uther. Double time on those oars, Bondon, and every able-bodied man jack among you better be ready or you'll be using your guts for pillows.
Roran remained where he was as the Dragonwing exploded with activity. Despite the increase in noise, he could still hear swords and shields clanging together in the distance. The screams of men were audible now, as were the roars of some giant beast. He glanced over as Jode joined them at the prow. The merchant's face was pale. "Have you ever been in battle before?" asked Roran. The knob in Jode's throat bobbed as he swallowed and shook his head. "I got into plenty of fights along with Bronn, but never anything of this scale. A first for both of us, then." The bank of smoke thinned on the right, providing them with a glimpse of a dark land that belched forth fire and putrid orange vapour and was covered with masses of struggling men. It was impossible to tell who was the Empire and who was the Varden, but it was apparent to Roran that the battle could tip in either direction given the right nudge. We can provide that nudge. Then a voice echoed over the water as a man shouted, A ship! A ship is coming up the Jeet River! You should go below decks, said Roran to Elaine. It won't be safe for you here. She nodded and hurried to the fore hatchway where she climbed down the ladder, closing the opening behind her. A moment later, Horst bounded up to the prow and handed Roran one of Fisk's shields.
Thought you might need that, said Horst.
Thanks, I... Roran stopped as the air around them vibrated as if from a mighty concussion.
Thud!
His teeth jarred together.
Thud!
His ears hurt from the pressure. Close upon the heels of the second impact came a third thud, and with it a raw-throated yell that Roran recognized, for he had heard it many times in his childhood. He looked up and beheld a gigantic sapphire dragon diving out of the shifting clouds. And on the dragon's back, at the juncture between its neck and shoulders, sat his cousin, Aragorn. It was not the Aragorn he remembered, but rather as if an artist had taken his cousin's base features and enhanced them, streamlined them, making them both more noble and more feline. This Aragorn was garbed like a prince in fine cloth and armour, though tarnished by the grime of war, and in his right hand he wielded a blade of iridescent red. This Aragorn, Roran knew, could kill without hesitation. This Aragorn was powerful and implacable. This Aragorn could slay the Razak and their mounts and help him to rescue Katrina. Flaring its translucent wings, the dragon pulled up sharply and hung before the ship. Then Aragorn met Roran's eyes. Until that moment, Roran had not completely believed Jode's story about Aragorn and Brom. Now, as he stared at his cousin, a wave of confused emotions washed over him. Aragorn is a rider. It seemed inconceivable that the slight, moody, overeager boy he grew up with had turned into this fearsome warrior. Seeing him alive again filled Roran with unexpected joy, yet at the same time a terrible, familiar anger welled up inside him over Aragorn's role in Garrow's death and the siege of Carvajal. In those few seconds, Roran knew not whether he loved or hated Aragorn.
He stiffened with alarm as a vast and alien being touched his mind. From that consciousness emanated Eragon's voice.
Roran?
Aye.
Think your answers and I'll hear them. Is everyone from Carvajal with you?
Just about.
How did you... No, we can't go into it. There's no time. Stay where you are until the battle is decided. Better yet, go back farther down the river, where the Empire can't attack you.
We have to talk, Eragon. You have much to answer for.
Eragon hesitated with a troubled expression, then said,
I know, but not now, later.
With no visible prompting, the dragon veered away from the ship and flew off to the east, vanishing in the haze over the burning plains. In an awed voice, Horst said,
A rider! A real rider! I never thought I'd see the day, much less that it would be Eragon.
He shook his head.
I guess you told us the truth, eh, Longshanks?
Jode grinned in response, looking like a delighted child. Their words sounded muted to Roran as he stared at the deck, feeling like he was about to explode with tension. A host of unanswerable questions assailed him. He forced himself to ignore them.
I can't think about Eragon now. We have to fight. The Vardan must defeat the Empire. A rising tide of fury consumed him. He had experienced this before, a berserk frenzy that allowed him to overcome nearly any obstacle, to move objects he could not shift ordinarily, to face an enemy in combat and feel no fear.
It gripped him now, a fever in his veins, quickening his breath and setting his heart a-pounding. He pushed himself off the railing, ran the length of the ship to the quarterdeck, where Uthar stood by the wheel, and said,
Ground the ship!
What?
Ground the ship, I say! Stay here with the rest of the soldiers, and use the ballistae to wreak what havoc you can. Keep the dragon wing from being boarded, and guard our families with your lives, understand?
Uthar stared at him with flat eyes, and Roran feared he would not accept the orders. Then the scarred sailor grunted and said,
Aye, aye, strong hammer!
Horst's heavy tread preceded his arrival at the quarterdeck.
What do you intend to do, Roran?
Do?
Roran laughed and spun widdershins to stand toe-to-toe with the smith.
Do? Why, I intend to alter the fate of Alagazia.
Eldest.
Eragon barely noticed as Saphira carried him back into the swirling confusion of the battle. He had known that Roran was at sea, but it never occurred to him that Roran might be heading for Surda, nor that they would reunite in this manner. And Roran's eyes! His eyes seemed to bore into Eragon, questioning, relieved, enraged, accusing. In them, Eragon saw that his cousin had learned of Eragon's role in Garrow's death and had not yet forgiven him. It was only when a sword bounced off his greaves that Eragon returned his attention to his surroundings. He unleashed a hoarse shout and slashed downward, cutting away the soldier who struck him. Cursing himself for being so careless, Eragon reached out to Triana and said,
No one on that ship is an enemy. Spread the word that they're not to be attacked. Ask Nasuada if, as a favour to us, she can send a herald to explain the situation to them and see that they stay away from the fighting.
As you wish, Arjadlam.
From the western flank of the battle where she alighted, Saphira traversed the burning plains in a few giant leaps, stopping before Hrothgar and his dwarves. Dismounting, Eragon went to the king, who said,
Hail, Arjadlam! Hail, Saphira! The elves seem to have done more for you than they promised.
Beside him stood Oric.
No, sir, it was the dragons.
Really? I must hear your adventures once our bloody work here is done. I'm glad you accepted my offer to become Durgrimst in Jeetum. It is an honour to have you as mine kin.
And you mine.
Hrothgar laughed, then turned to Saphira and said,
I still haven't forgotten your vow to mend Isidar Mithrim, dragon. Even now our artisans are assembling the star sapphire in the centre of Trondheim. I look forward to seeing it whole once again.
She bowed her head.
As I promised, so it shall be.
After Eragon repeated her words, Hrothgar reached out with a gnarled finger
and tapped one of the metal plates on her side.
I see you wear our armor. I hope it has served you well.
Very well, King Hrothgar,
said Saphira through Aragorn.
It has saved me many an injury.
Hrothgar straightened and lifted Volund, a twinkle in his deep-set eyes.
Well then, shall we march out and test it once again in the Forge of War?
He looked back at his warriors and shouted,
Axartos und Durgrimst!
Vor Hrothgar's Korda! Vor Hrothgar's Korda!
Aragorn looked at Oric, who translated with a mighty yell,
By Hrothgar's hammer!
Joining the chant, Aragorn ran with the dwarf king toward the crimson ranks of soldiers, Saphira by his side. Now, at last, with the help of the dwarves, the battle turned in favour of the Varden. Together they pushed back the Empire, dividing them, crushing them, forcing Galbatorix's vast army to abandon positions they had held since morn. Their efforts were helped by the fact that more of Angela's poisons had taken effect. Many of the Empire's officers behaved irrationally, giving orders that made it easier for the Varden to penetrate deeper into the army, sowing chaos as they went. The soldiers seemed to realize that fortune no longer smiled upon them, for hundreds surrendered or defected outright and turned on their former comrades or threw down their weapons and fled. And the day passed into the late afternoon. Aragorn was in the midst of fighting two soldiers when a flaming javelin roared past overhead and buried itself in one of the Empire's command tents, 20 yards away, igniting the fabric. Dispatching his opponents, Aragorn glanced back and saw dozens of fiery missiles arcing out from the ship on the Jeet River. What are you playing at, Roran? Wondered Aragorn before charging the next batch of soldiers. Soon afterward, a horn echoed from the rear of the Empire's army, then another and another. Someone began to pound a sonorous drum, the peals of which stilled the field, as everyone looked about for the source of the beat. Even as Aragorn watched, an ominous figure detached itself from the horizon in the north and rose up in the lurid sky over the burning plains. The gore crows scattered before the barbed black shadow, which balanced motionless upon the thermals. At first Aragorn thought it a leather blacker, one of the Razak's mounts. Then a ray of light escaped the clouds and struck the figure crossways from the west. A red dragon floated above them, glowing and sparkling in the sunbeam like a bed of blood-red coals. His wing membranes were the colour of wine held before a lantern. His claws and teeth and the spikes along his spine were white as snow. In his vermilion eyes there gleamed a terrible glee. On his back was fixed a saddle, and in that saddle sat a man garbed in polished steel armour and armed with a hand-and-a-half sword. Dread clutched at Aragorn. Galbatorix managed to get another dragon to hatch. Then the man in steel raised his left hand, and a shaft of crackling ruby energy sprang from his palm and smote Hrothgar on the breast. The dwarf spellcasters cried out with agony as the energy from their bodies was consumed, trying to block the attack. They collapsed, dead. Then Hrothgar clutched his heart and toppled to the ground. The dwarves gave a great groan of despair as they saw their king fall.
No!
Cried Aragorn, and Saphira roared in protest. He glared with hate at the enemy rider.
I'll kill you for that!
Aragorn knew that as they were, he and Saphira were too tired to confront such a mighty opponent. Glancing around, Aragorn spotted a horse lying in the mud, a spear through its side. The stallion was still alive. Aragorn put his hand on its neck and murmured, Sleep, brother. Then he transferred the horse's remaining vitality into himself and Saphira. It was not enough energy to restore all their strength, but it soothed their aching muscles and stopped their limbs from shaking. Rejuvenated, Aragorn leaped onto Saphira, shouting, Oric, take command of your kinsmen! Across the field he saw Arya gaze at him with concern. He put her out of his mind as he tightened the saddle straps around his legs. Then Saphira launched herself toward the red dragon, pumping her wings at a furious rate to gain the necessary speed. I hope you remember your lessons with Glaedha, he said. He tightened his grip on his shield. Saphira did not answer him, but roared out with her thoughts at the other dragon.
Traitor! Egg-breaker! Oath-breaker! Murderer!
Then as one, she and Aragorn assaulted the minds of the pair, seeking to overwhelm their defences. The consciousness of the rider felt strange to Aragorn, as if it contained multitudes. Scores of distinct voices whispered in the caverns of his mind, like imprisoned spirits begging for release. The instant they made contact, the rider retaliated with a blast of pure force greater than any even Oromis was capable of summoning. Aragorn retreated deep behind his own barriers, frantically reciting a scrap of doggerel Oromis taught him to use in such predicaments. Under a cold and empty winter sky stood a wee small man with a silver sword. He jumped and stabbed in a fevered frenzy, fighting the shadows massed before him. The siege on Aragorn's mind abated as Saphira and the Red Dragon crashed together, two incandescent meteors colliding head-on. They grappled, kicking each other's bellies with their hind legs. Their talons produced hideous screeches as they grated against Saphira's armour and the Red Dragon's flat scales. The Red Dragon was smaller than Saphira, but thicker in his legs and shoulders. He managed to kick her off for a moment, then they closed again, each struggling to get their jaws around the other's neck. It was all Aragorn could do to keep hold of Zarok as the dragons tumbled toward the ground, battering one another with terrible blows from their feet and tails. No more than 50 yards above the burning plains, Saphira and the Red Dragon disengaged, struggling to regain altitude. Once she halted her descent, Saphira reared her head like a snake about to strike and loosed a thick torrent of fire. It never reached its destination. 12 feet from the Red Dragon, the fire bifurcated and passed harmlessly on either side. "Blast it!" thought Aragorn. Even as the Red Dragon opened its maw to retaliate, Aragorn cried,
"Scholar Nosu fra Brisinger!"
He was just in time. The conflagration swirled around them, but did not even scorch Saphira's scales. Now Saphira and the Red Dragon raced up through the striated smoke into the clear, chill sky beyond, darting back and forth as they tried to climb above their opponent. The Red Dragon nipped Saphira's tail, and she and Aragorn yelped with shared pain. Panting from the effort, Saphira executed a tight backward loop, ending up behind the dragon, who then pivoted to the left and tried to spiral up and over Saphira. While the dragons duelled with increasingly complex acrobatics, Aragorn became aware of a disturbance on the burning plains. The spellcasters of Dúvrangorgata were beset by 2 new magicians from the Empire. These magicians were far more powerful than those who had preceded them. They had already killed one of Dúvrangorgata and were battering past the barriers of a second. Aragorn heard Triana scream with her mind,
"Shade Slayer, you have to help us! We can't stop them! They'll kill all the Varden! Help us! It's the—"
Her voice was lost to him as the rider stabbed at his consciousness.
"This must end,"
spat Aragorn between clenched teeth as he strove to withstand the onslaught. Over Saphira's neck he saw the Red Dragon dive toward them, angling beneath Saphira. Aragorn dared not open his mind enough to talk with Saphira, so he said out loud,
"Catch me!"
With 2 strokes of Zarok, he severed the straps around his legs and jumped off Saphira's back.
"This is insane!" thought Aragorn.
He laughed with giddy exhilaration as the feeling of weightlessness took hold of him. The rush of air tore off his helm and made his eyes water and sting. Releasing his shield, Aragorn spread out his arms and legs, as Oromis had taught him, in order to stabilize his flight. Below, the steel-clad rider noticed Aragorn's action. The Red Dragon shied to Aragorn's left, but could not evade him. Aragorn lashed out with Zarok as the dragon's flank flashed by, and he felt the blade sink into the creature's hamstring before his momentum carried him past. The dragon roared in agony. The impact of the blow sent Aragorn spinning up, down and around. By the time he managed to stop his rotation, he had plummeted through the cloud cover and was heading toward a swift and fatal landing on the burning plains. He could stop himself with magic if he had to, but it would drain his last reserves of energy. He glanced over both his shoulders.
"Come on, Saphira, where are you?"
As if in answer, she dropped out of the foul smoke, her wings pressed tight against her body. She swooped underneath him and opened her wings a bit to slow her fall. Careful not to impale himself on one of her spikes, Eragon manoeuvred himself back into the saddle, welcoming the return of gravity as she pulled out of the dive.
"Never do that to me again!" she snapped.
He surveyed the steaming blood that laced Zarok's blade.
"It worked, didn't it?"
His satisfaction disappeared as he realized that his stunt had placed Sephira at the mercy of the Red Dragon. He hurtled at her from above, harrying her this way and that as he forced her toward the ground. Sephira tried to maneuver out from under him, but every time she did, he dove at her, biting and buffeting her with his wings in order to make her change course. The dragons twisted and lunged until their tongues lolled out of their mouths, their tails drooped, and they gave up flapping and merely glided. His mind once again closed to all contact, friendly or not, Eragon said out loud, "Land, Sephira, it's no good! I'll fight him on the ground!" With a grunt of weary resignation, Sephira descended to the nearest flat open area, a small stone plateau set along the western edge of the Jeet River. The water had turned red from the blood pouring into it from the battle. Eragon jumped off Sephira once she alighted on the plateau and tested his footing. It was smooth and hard, with nothing to trip on. He nodded, pleased. A few seconds later, the Red Dragon rushed by overhead and settled on the opposite side of the plateau. He held his left hind leg off the ground to avoid aggravating his wound, a long gash that nearly severed the muscle. The dragon trembled his entire length like an injured dog. He tried to hop forward, then stopped and snarled at Eragon. The enemy rider unbuckled his legs and slid down the uninjured side of his dragon. Then he walked around the dragon and examined his leg. Eragon let him. He knew how much pain it would cause the man to see the damage inflicted on his bonded partner. He waited too long, though, for the rider muttered a few indecipherable words, and within the span of 3 seconds, the dragon's injury was healed. Eragon shivered with fear. How could he do that so quickly and with such a short spell? Still, whoever he might be, the new rider certainly was not Galbatorix, whose dragon was black. Eragon clung to that knowledge as he stepped forward to confront the rider. As they met in the center of the plateau, Sephira and the Red Dragon circled in the background. The rider grasped his sword with both hands and swung it over his head toward Eragon, who lifted Zarok to defend himself. Their blades collided with a burst of crimson sparks. Then Eragon shoved back his opponent and started a complex series of blows. He stabbed and parried, dancing on light feet as he forced the steel-clad rider to retreat toward the edge of the plateau. When they reached the edge, the rider held his ground, fending off Eragon's attacks, no matter how clever.
"It's as if he can anticipate my every move," thought Eragon, frustrated.
If he were rested, it would have been easy for him to defeat the rider. But as it was, he could make no headway. The rider did not have the speed and strength of an elf, but his technical skill was better than Vanna's and as good as Eragon's. Eragon felt a touch of panic when his initial surge of energy began to subside, and he had accomplished nothing more than a slight scratch across the rider's gleaming breastplate. The last reserves of power stored in Zarok's ruby and the belt of Beloth the Wise were only enough to maintain his exertions for another minute. Then the rider took a step forward, then another, and before Eragon knew it, they had returned to the center of the plateau, where they stood facing each other, exchanging blows. Zarok grew so heavy in his hand, Eragon could barely lift it. His shoulder burned, he gasped for breath, and sweat poured off his face. Not even his desire to avenge Hrothgar could help him to overcome his exhaustion. At last, Eragon slipped and fell. Determined not to be killed lying down, he rolled back onto his feet and stabbed at the rider, who knocked aside Zarok with a lazy flick of his wrist. The way the rider flourished his sword afterward, spinning it in a quick circle by his side, suddenly seemed familiar to Eragon, as did all his preceding swordsmanship. He stared with growing horror at his enemy's hand-and-a-half sword, then back up at the eye slits of his mirrored helm and shouted, "I know you!" He threw himself at the rider, trapping both swords between their bodies, hooked his fingers underneath the helm, and ripped it off. And there, in the centre of the plateau, on the edge of the burning plains of Alagazia, stood Murtagh. Inheritance. Murtagh grinned. Then he said, "Thrysta Vindar," and a hard ball of air coalesced between them and struck Aragorn in the middle of his chest, tossing him 20 feet across the plateau. Aragorn heard Saphira growl as he landed on his back. His vision flashed red and white, then he curled into a ball and waited for the pain to recede. Any delight he felt in Murtagh's reappearance was overwhelmed by the macabre circumstances of their meeting. An unstable mixture of shock, confusion, and anger boiled within him. Lowering his sword, Murtagh pointed at Aragorn with his steel-encased hand, curling every finger but his index into a spiny fist. "You never would give up." A chill crept along Aragorn's spine, for he recognized the scene from his premonition while rafting the Aj Ragni to Hedoth. A man sprawled in the clotted mud with a dented helm and bloody mail, his face concealed behind an upthrown arm. An armored hand entered Aragorn's view and pointed at the downed man with all the authority of fate itself. Past and future had converged. Now Aragorn's doom would be decided. Pushing himself to his feet, he coughed and said,
"Murtagh, how can you be alive? I watched the Urgals drag you underground. I tried to scry you, but saw only darkness."
Murtagh uttered a mirthless laugh. "You saw nothing. Just as I saw nothing the times I tried to scry you during my days in Urubain."
"You died, though!" shouted Aragorn, almost incoherent. "You died under Fardan Dûr. Arya found your bloody clothes in the tunnels."
A shadow darkened Murtagh's face. "No, I did not die. It was the twins' doing, Aragorn. They took control of a group of Urgals and arranged the ambush in order to kill Ajihad and capture me. Then they ensorcelled me so I could not escape and spirited me off to Urubain." Aragorn shook his head, unable to comprehend what had happened.
"But why did you agree to serve Galbatorix? You told me you hated him. You told me..."
"Agree?" Murtagh laughed again, and this time his outburst contained an edge of madness. "I did not agree. First, Galbatorix punished me for spiting his years of protection during my upbringing in Urubain, for defying his will and running away. Then he extracted everything I knew about you, Saphira, and the Vardan."
"You betrayed us! I was mourning you, and you betrayed us! I had no choice!"
"Ajihad was right to lock you up. He should have let you rot in your cell. Then none of this..."
"I had no choice!" snarled Murtagh. "And after Thorin hatched for me, Galbatorix forced both of us to swear loyalty to him in the ancient language. We cannot disobey him now."
Pity and disgust welled inside of Aragorn.
"You have become your father."
A strange gleam leaped into Murtagh's eyes. "No, not my father. I'm stronger than Morzan ever was. Galbatorix taught me things about magic you've never even dreamed of. Spells so powerful the elves dare not utter them, cowards that they are. Words in the ancient language that were lost until Galbatorix discovered them. Ways to manipulate energy, secrets, terrible secrets that can destroy your enemies and fulfill all your desires." Aragorn thought back to some of Oromus's lessons and retorted, "Things that should remain secrets." "If you knew, you would not say that. Brom was a dabbler, nothing more. And the elves, bah! All they can do is hide in their forest and wait to be conquered." Murtagh ran his eyes over Aragorn. "You look like an elf now. Did Islanzadi do that to you?" When Aragorn remained silent, Murtagh smiled and shrugged. "No matter. I'll learn the truth soon enough." He stopped, frowned, then looked to the east. Following his gaze, Aragorn saw the twins standing at the front of the Empire, casting balls of energy into the midst of the Varden and the dwarves. The curtains of smoke made it difficult to tell, but Aragorn was sure the hairless magicians were grinning and laughing as they slaughtered the men with whom they once pledged solemn friendship. What the twins failed to notice, and what was clearly visible to Aragorn and Murtagh from their vantage point, was that Roran was crawling toward them from the side. Aragorn's heart skipped a beat as he recognized his cousin.
"You fool, get away from them! You'll be killed!"
just as he opened his mouth to cast a spell that would transport Roran out of danger, no matter the cost, Murtagh said, "Wait. I want to see what he'll do."
"Why?"
A bleak smile crossed Murtagh's face. "The twins enjoyed tormenting me when I was their captive." Aragorn glanced at him, suspicious.
"You won't hurt him? You won't warn the twins?"
"Vel ein raden iete shirtigal." "Upon my word as a rider." Together they watched as Roran hid behind a mound of bodies. Aragorn stiffened as the twins looked toward the pile. For a moment it seemed they had spotted him. Then they turned away and Roran jumped up. He swung his hammer and bashed one of the twins in the head, cracking open his skull. The remaining twin fell to the ground, convulsing, and emitted a wordless scream until he too met his end under Roran's hammer. Then Roran planted his foot upon the corpses of his foes, lifted his hammer over his head, and bellowed his victory. "What now?" demanded Aragorn, turning away from the battlefield. "Are you here to kill me?"
"Of course not. Galbatorix wants you alive."
"What for?" Murtagh's lips quirked. "You don't know? Ha! There's a fine jest. It's not because of you. It's because of her." He jabbed a finger at Saphira. "The dragon inside Galbatorix's last egg, the last dragon egg in the world, is male. Saphira is the only female dragon in existence. If she breeds, she will be the mother of her entire race. Do you see now? Galbatorix doesn't want to eradicate the dragons. He wants to use Saphira to rebuild the riders. He can't kill you, either of you, if his vision is to become reality. And what a vision it is, Aragorn. You should hear him describe it. Then you might not think so badly of him. Is it evil that he wants to unite Alagesia under a single banner, eliminate the need for war, and restore the riders? He's the one who destroyed the riders in the first place. And for good reason," asserted Murtagh. "They were old, fat, and corrupt. The elves controlled them and used them to subjugate humans. They had to be removed so that we could start anew." A furious scowl contorted Aragorn's features. He paced back and forth across the plateau, his breathing heavy, then gestured at the battle and said, "How can you justify causing so much suffering on the basis of a madman's ravings? Galbatorix has done nothing but burn and slaughter and amass power for himself. He lies, he murders, he manipulates. You know this. It's why you refused to work for him in the first place." Aragorn paused, then adopted a gentler tone. "I can understand that you were compelled to act against your will and that you aren't responsible for killing Hrothgar. You can try to escape, though. I'm sure that Arya and I could devise a way to neutralize the bonds Galbatorix has laid upon you. Join me, Murtagh. You could do so much for the Vardan. With us you would be praised and admired instead of cursed, feared and hated." For a moment, as Murtagh gazed down at his notched sword, Aragorn hoped he would accept. Then Murtagh said in a low voice, "You cannot help me, Aragorn. No one but Galbatorix can release us from our oaths, and he will never do that. He knows our true names, Aragorn. We are his slaves forever." Though he wanted to, Aragorn could not deny the sympathy he felt for Murtagh's plight. With the utmost gravity, he said, "Then let us kill the two of you."
"Kill us? Why should we allow that?"
Aragorn chose his words with care.
"It would free you from Galbatorix's control, and it would save the lives of hundreds, if not thousands, of people. Isn't that a noble enough cause to sacrifice yourself for?"
Murtagh shook his head. "Maybe for you, but life is still too sweet for me to part with it so easily. No stranger's life is more important than Thorne's or my own." As much as he hated it, hated the entire situation, in fact, Aragorn knew then what had to be done. Renewing his attack on Murtagh's mind, he leaped forward, both feet leaving the ground as he lunged toward Murtagh, intending to stab him through the heart.
"Let her!"
barked Murtagh. Aragorn dropped back to the ground as invisible bands clamped around his arms and legs, immobilizing him. To his right, Saphira discharged a jet of rippling fire and sprang at Murtagh like a cat pouncing on a mouse.
"Raisa!"
commanded Murtagh, extending a claw-like hand as if to catch her. Saphira yelped with surprise as Murtagh's incantation stopped her in mid-air and held her in place, floating several feet above the plateau. No matter how much she wriggled, she could not touch the ground, nor could she fly any higher.
"How can he still be human and have the strength to do that?" wondered Aragorn. "Even with my new abilities, such a task would leave me gasping for air and unable to walk."
Relying upon his experience, counteracting Oromus's spells, Aragorn said,
"Braca duvanyali semhwilda Saphira uneka."
Murtagh made no attempt to stop him, only gave him a flat stare as if he found Aragorn's resistance a pointless inconvenience. Baring his teeth, Aragorn redoubled his efforts. His hands went cold, his bones ached, and his pulse slowed as the magic sapped his energy. Without being asked, Saphira joined forces with him, granting him access to the formidable resources of her body. 5 seconds passed. 20 seconds. A thick vein pulsed on Murtagh's neck. A minute. A minute and a half. Involuntary tremors racked Aragorn. His quadriceps and hamstrings fluttered, and his legs would have given way if he were free to move. 2 minutes passed. At last, Aragorn was forced to release the magic, else he risked falling unconscious and passing into the void. He sagged, utterly spent. He had been afraid before, but only because he thought he might fail. Now he was afraid because he did not know what Murtagh was capable of. "You cannot hope to compete with me," said Murtagh. "No one can, except for Galbatorix." Walking up to Aragorn, he pointed his sword at Aragorn's neck, pricking his skin. Aragorn resisted the impulse to flinch. "It would be so easy to take you back to Urubain." Aragorn gazed deep into his eyes. "Don't. Let me go. You just tried to kill me. And you would have done the same in my position." When Murtagh remained silent and expressionless, Aragorn said, "We were friends once. We fought together. Galbatorix can't have twisted you so much that you've forgotten. If you do this, Murtagh, you'll be lost forever." A long minute passed, where the only sound was the hue and cry of the clashing armies. Blood trickled down Aragorn's neck from where the sword point cut him. Saphira lashed her tail with helpless rage. Finally, Murtagh said, "I was ordered to try and capture you and Saphira." He paused. "I have tried. Make sure we don't cross paths again. Galbatorix will have me swear additional oaths in the ancient language that will prevent me from showing you such mercy when next we meet." He lowered his sword.
"You're doing the right thing," said Aragorn. He tried to step back, but was still held in place.
"Perhaps.
But before I let you go..."
Reaching out, Murtagh pried Zarok from Aragorn's fist and unbuckled Zarok's red sheath from the belt of Beloth the Wise. "If I have become my father, then I will have my father's blade. Thorn is my dragon, and a thorn he shall be to all our enemies. It is only right, then, that I should also wield the sword Misery. Misery and Thorn, a fit match. Besides, Zarok should have gone to Morzan's eldest son, not his youngest. It is mine, by right of birth." A cold pit formed in Aragorn's stomach.
"It can't be!"
A cruel smile appeared on Murtagh's face.
"I never told you my mother's name, did I? And you never told me yours. I'll say it now. Selina. Selina was my mother and your mother. Morzan was our father. The twins figured out the connection while they were digging around in your head. Galbatorix was quite interested to learn that particular piece of information."
"You're lying!" cried Aragorn. He could not bear the thought of being Morzan's son.
Did Brom know? Does Oromis know? Why didn't they tell me?
He remembered then Angela predicting that someone in his family would betray him.
She was right.
Murtag merely shook his head and repeated his words in the ancient language, then put his lips to Aragorn's ear and whispered,
"You and I, we are the same, Aragorn. Mirror images of one another. You can't deny it."
"You're wrong,"
growled Aragorn, struggling against the spell.
"We're nothing alike. I don't have a scar on my back anymore."
Murtag recoiled as if he had been stung, his face going hard and cold. He lifted Zarok and held it upright before his chest.
"So be it. I take my inheritance from you, brother. Farewell."
Then he retrieved his helm from the ground and pulled himself onto Thorn. Not once did he look at Aragorn as the dragon crouched, raised its wings, and flew off the plateau and into the north. Only after Thorn vanished below the horizon did the web of magic release Aragorn and Saphira. Saphira's talons clicked on the stone as she landed. She crawled over to Aragorn and touched him on the arm with her snout.
"Are you all right, little one?"
"I'm fine."
But he was not, and she knew it. Walking to the edge of the plateau, Aragorn surveyed the burning plains and the aftermath of the battle. For the battle was over. With the death of the twins, the Varden and dwarves regained lost ground and were able to rout the formations of confused soldiers, herding them into the river or chasing them back from whence they came. Though the bulk of their forces remained intact, the Empire had sounded the retreat, no doubt to regroup and prepare for a second attempt to invade Sordor. In their wake, they left piles of tangled corpses from both sides of the conflict, enough men and dwarves to populate an entire city. Thick, black smoke roiled off the bodies that had fallen into the peat fires. Now that the fighting had subsided, the hawks and eagles, the crows and ravens, descended like a shroud over the field. Aragorn closed his eyes, tears leaking from under the lids. They had won, but he had lost.
Reunion.
Aragorn and Saphira picked their way between the corpses that littered the burning plains, moving slowly on account of their wounds and their exhaustion. They encountered other survivors staggering through the scorched battlefield, hollow-eyed men who looked without truly seeing, their gazes focused somewhere in the distance. Now that his bloodlust had subsided, Aragorn felt nothing but sorrow. The fighting seemed so pointless to him. What a tragedy that so many must die to thwart a single madman. He paused to sidestep a thicket of arrows planted in the mud and noticed the gash on Saphira's tail where Thorn had bitten her, as well as her other injuries. "Here, lend me your strength. I'll heal you."
"Tend to those in mortal danger first."
"Are you sure?"
"Quite sure, little one."
Acquiescing, he bent down and mended a soldier's torn neck before moving on to one of the Varden. He made no distinction between friend and foe, treating both to the limit of his abilities. Aragorn was so preoccupied with his thoughts, he paid little attention to his work. He wished he could repudiate Murtag's claim, but everything Murtag had said about his mother, their mother, coincided with the few things Aragorn knew about her. Selina left Carvajal 20-some years ago, returned once to give birth to Aragorn, and was never seen again. His mind darted back to when he and Murtag first arrived in Farthendor. Murtag had discussed how his mother had vanished from Morzan's castle while Morzan was hunting Brom, Jode, and Saphira's egg. After Morzan threw Zarok at Murtag and nearly killed him, mother must have hidden her pregnancy and then gone back to Carvajal in order to protect me from Morzan and Galbatorix. It heartened Aragorn to know that Selina had cared for him so deeply. It also grieved him to know she was dead, and they would never meet, for he had nurtured the hope, faint as it was, that his parents might still be alive. He no longer harboured any desire to be acquainted with his father, but he bitterly resented that he had been deprived of the chance to have a relationship with his mother. Ever since he was old enough to understand that he was a fosterling,
Aragorn had wondered who his father was, and why his mother left him to be raised by her brother Garrow and his wife Marion. Those answers had been thrust upon him from such an unexpected source and in such an unpropitious setting. It was more than he could make sense of at the moment. It would take months, if not years, to come to